It's Danger Mouse time once again. Recording in progress, folks. It's Mikey here. I'm a bit shagged out because I've been canoeing everywhere because it's sunny and there's a chap over from Florida who's paddling around the whole British Isles that I had to, I didn't have to. I voluntarily hosted and said hello to and stuff. So I'm totally unhappily out of it. And so special welcome for our first dog and man pair. So we've got William here from Bodmin in Cornwall. Now, the fascinating thing about Cornwall is that it's, because the theme of today is story, and Cornwall itself is a story, if you think about it. All this kind of, the history of mining and fishing, and it actually claims to be its own country. So, and now that Daryl has officially accepted that it's superior to Devon, implicitly by having a holiday here, I don't know. I just really don't know what I'm talking about. So the key thing about our guest today, William, is he's a storyteller and he lives in Bodmin, which used to be the county town of Cornwall until Truro snatched it away from it. So we'll be talking about stories. We'll be talking about the Beast of Bodmin, maybe. William, own up. You're not the Beast of Bodmin, are you?
Well, there's been rumours.
And Daryl desperately talk about contradictions every now and again. Is that right, Daryl?
Well, contradictions and stories, they're intimately connected, aren't they?
Good. So he'll be trying to drag it down to being sensible. And William and I will kind of do the converse. So William, tell us about yourself and tell us how a man from the Midland ended up in Bodmin, of all places.
I would say Bodmin is the most Midland-like town probably in
Cornwall. Now, you shocked me straight away. I mean, what's the connection between Bodmin and the Midlands?
It's not so much, really. But it's for the size of town that it is, I think you sacrifice creature comforts and amenities a little bit when you pick some of the nicer places to live in Cornwall. Especially, I mean, a lot of people we work with tend to be in Foy, Mevagissey, coastal towns, river towns. Bodmin, you've got the main road right there. You've got Aldi and Lidl and Morrison's and Sainsbury's and Asda and everything you expect in the Midlands. So it's a little bit more like where I grew up than some of the other places in the Midlands, although it's got a lot of character that the Midlands doesn't have. I mean, the Midlands is all manufacturing. The history in the Midlands is mostly manufactories and factories, things like that. I mean, where I grew up, it was hosiery.
Hosiery. Oh, that's very, I can't think of a word. It's very something.
Very dull.
So you mentioned your current business. And what is that?
That is, so I'm a cabinet maker. So we make high-end bedrooms and kitchens, mostly bedrooms. The kitchens we do are only very high-end bespoke kitchens, and we don't advertise so much. There's a lot of people fighting over the bone when it comes to kitchens.
So. Right, but you've gone straight for the top, yeah, where the money is.
Yeah, it's all top-end, all handmade doors. I know you guys like your innovation. We like our tradition.
Excellent. Yes. Well, I wish some people that say they're innovators would actually realise that their customers don't want innovation. They just want high quality stuff that's is the same as it's always been.
Yes. Yes. I mean, me and my other half, she's a shoemaker by trade. She's not a shoemaker at the moment. She's a qualified leather inspector, qualified shoemaker. And there's a trade-off there when you innovate. You may focus on that profit line going up and being able to get more product out to your consumers. But the byproduct of that might be that the country then loses skills for good. So when Dr. Martin's outsourced to, I think they do Taiwan, Portugal, probably some other places as well, and they shut down all of their UK factories. When they decided, I don't know how many years later it was, a number of years later, to reopen in the UK and reopen that original factory on Cobbs Lane, they found that they didn't have people with the skills to actually do the jobs. So the Made in England range, the vast majority, over 50% of the Made in England range of shoes, the uppers are stitched in Portugal or all over the world and then shipped back here for them to finish because there's not enough
Wow.
clothing shops in the UK.
That's
Oh,
amazing.
wow.
Yeah, it's yeah, there was a period probably about 40 years in my life where I only wore Doc Martens. But not anymore. Yeah, because of exactly that. It's yeah, it's not the same. It's
No.
yeah.
So
But
I
that's
was going to say, Daryl, I kind of associate you. That's your brand footwear.
I could probably open a Doc Martin museum if I
No,
wanted to, but yeah, it will be a museum
no,
of
no. Stop, stop there,
made of
stop
Ink made
there.
in
Are
England.
you saying you've kept all your bloody shoes, all your stinky, smelly, worn-out shoes
It's worse.
forever?
It's worse than that because I've been on eBay and places like that buying Doc Martin shoes that have probably never been worn to go in my
Sorry.
Made in England Doc Martin museum.
So why does that not surprise me? Why does that not surprise me? What you, so you actually lusted after Doc Martens? Sorry, just for the international audience, all half of them. Doc Martens is basically a ankle length leather boot with a plastic kind of sole that I guess must have been trending with some sort of pop group that Daryl's into.
Well, I think it hit another peak with sort of skinheads and then punk, I think. But it's been through phases. It's been several generations, but they went through a brilliant phase of really innovating. And so they kept the core the same. So don't innovate where people don't want you to innovate. But in terms of the style and patterns, then that's where they could see there's an opportunity, which admirably fell into the trap that they wanted me to fall into and bought lots and lots of pairs of.
Well, because they made collector's versions. Collector's,
Well,
yes.
limited edition. Yeah, limited editions. Yeah, so I think particularly with Generation X, yeah, don't try and categorize me. So even though almost every Generation X person bought Dr. Martin's shoes, then you do want to stand out from the crowd. So limited edition ones was the answer. But then, as William says, they stopped making them in England.
Right, okay, that's very sensible. So William. Tell us a quick recap of your life story of how somebody from the Midlands ended up making high quality furniture in Bodmin.
So I bummed around at home for a few years, uneducated.
Has anything changed?
No, I never got educated.
Right.
Threw myself
Very
into the
good,
world.
very commendable. Yes.
Everyone went off to uni and had fun, and I never did that. I think partly because I'm just not an academic person. I didn't do well in school and paying attention, and my own drive was quite, it's like a muscle, and it was not active. It wasn't
Oh,
atrophied
right.
because
It
it
was
was
not
erect in
developed.
the first place. Yeah, it was
Brilliant.
underdeveloped self-drive. But now I threw myself into the deep end and decided to move out of home and move to Bristol, because I went there to visit, fell in love with it, moved there, got the first job I could find, got sacked.
So, what do you get sacked for? That's very commendable.
I don't really know that. I don't think they liked me very much. I think they said you're very good with the customers, but your paperwork's atrocious.
There's a sign of the
Yeah,
times.
so they gave me the boot, and then I ended up working at a home centre, and then working my way up
Sorry,
from.
what's a home center?
So it's Bristol's largest independent retailer. So it's a 200-year-old business based in this lovely old soap factory in Bristol, and they started out. It was very much like Trego Mills of Bristol.
Oh, okay. So again, Trego Mills. Oh, how do we describe that? It's basically a very enterprising and very right-wing Cornishman started his own kind of version of a superstore that goes. There's three or four samples, and they are very, very quirky. Sell absolutely everything. Tries to be bargain basement price, but. Basically, the guy who ran it, he kept Cornwall pretty much entertained over many decades, fighting the council because he certainly didn't believe in following the rules. He felt rules were there to prevent him doing what, they quashed his spirit of enterprise. So if you're ever on the way on the A38 from Plymouth into Cornwall, you can stop at Trego Mills. I recommend it. Because it's a lovely sight in a valley, a wooded valley, with a river running through, and it's the first thing you see when you try and find the entrance, which is not that easy from the car park, is a load of statues, and they're basically quite a few of them are kind of grotesque depictions of some of the local councillors.
It is brilliant. It's worth walking around to read the plaques.
Yes, it's
Some of the people that he's tarred and feathered publicly are just like the most inane people you wouldn't have ever thought that he would ever have butted heads with. But it'll be like the local man that comes to check the water meter called Phil, and
really,
just
really.
yeah, some really
So
personal with these people.
if you imagine it, it's kind of like Donald Trump, but he wasn't given kind of £100 million by his dad, and he actually did build it up. Himself. So yes, he is the Cornish Donald Trump. Very good. Very good. How did we get onto that subject? That's you again, William.
So they were essentially, yeah, they were that. In fact, they have the same suppliers. It looked like it was something out of the 1970s, hadn't been updated for years, but I started work.
what was your part in this wonderful organization?
So I was started on the shop floor. And then was made into a bathroom designer because I was much better at chatting to customers than anything else. So I ended up being sort of a design and salesperson, then moved over to the kitchens department. And then when they renovated the place, they shut down and sold off the main building. And now that is, I've not been back to Bristol for years, so I've not seen it, but it was going to be luxury flats and office buildings. And they moved to the smaller building and it was much more design-led, design-focused. So I was the most senior bathroom person and doing kitchens as well. I was very good at that, but then my dad had moved to Cornwall. My grandparents had been in Cornwall since the 80s. He moved to Cornwall, and the person that he left running his old business wasn't really doing a fantastic job. They weren't really doing anything about getting new sales in. The website was stagnating. And I'd had previously to that a career as a graphic designer. There's lots of other bits, Carl. I'm really bad at telling my own story. So I was a graphic designer once.
So where did that happen?
I did go to college to get some education, and then didn't fancy uni and went and got a job as a graphic designer with a BTEC. Did that for a while, but it was things like designing booklets for B&Q for their
So
internal
is this so
use.
you can buy yourself a snazzy
No, I always had bangers.
motor?
It was so I could go uptown and drink cider and eat fried chicken.
So somewhere along the line, I think I've got the kind of the thread of that story. Somewhere along the line, you wanted to be an author. So where does that come from?
So I've always read a lot since I got glasses. I struggled at the beginning of school because I couldn't see anything. So I couldn't pay attention in class. So I'd just sit there twiddling my thumbs and looking out the window because I couldn't see anything that was on board or see anything that was in a book. When I got glasses, I then picked up books. I think I started with things like Famous Five and Mr. Magee,
Right.
and then Harry Potter came out, and that was like a big thing. And then from there into like young adult books like Philip Pullman.
Oh yeah. Absolutely love Philip Pullman. Well, I'm a bit older than you. I was reading it to the kids, but I remember when I discovered it, I thought wonderful. And incidentally, I think Famous Five Five go to Kiran Island. So basically, the famous five series were written by Edith Blyth, and they're basically a bunch of four upper class kids who used to get shipped out by their parents because they didn't want them around to various places around the country, and they used to have just wonderful adventurous holidays. It was totally different to the way children are wrapped up in cotton wool. They used to kind of go down mines and row to islands and things like that. And I put that down to one of the reasons that I'm now canoeing around the place, because that really did stir up my spirit of adventure, which shows you the power of stories. And the other thing you've got to be thinking, because I know you want to know that, is it's just fascinating that it could be something as simple as not having the right pair of glasses that stopped you going to university. And Daryl and I, it took me a long time to work it out. I think Daryl rebelled against formal education much more, much quicker than I did. We think that formal education can have rather a number of negative effects on you in terms of making you very conformist. And I found on more than one occasion, because it also makes me very prejudiced against people who haven't had education, higher education. I'm thinking, well, because they didn't try hard enough like I did, and because I was a right little swot, really. And it really phases me when I meet somebody who hasn't been to university, and I think, bloody hell, they're really clever. In fact, they're cleverer than I am. And that kind of turns my world upside down. In one case, it sent me into fairly deep depression. One of my early jobs, one of the guys in my team, who later went on very early age to become a technical director, he was just running circles around me, and I was totally fucking clueless, even though I had a good degree and everything like that. So, Daryl, has that ever happened to you? Of course.
I'm interested because I theoretically go into the education system to be an educator, and I
Yeah.
think what's always frustrated me is that I think between the age of 8 and 16, unwittingly, the education system just squeezes the creativity out of people, and it's I think it's an education system that's built on the creating soldiers for the Prussian military, basically, which means you don't want an awful lot of creativity. You want people who are going to follow orders. And be competent. But in terms of if you want a society full of creative people, then the education system we've got is disastrous.
But the other thing it does is it puts people in boxes. And I've certainly met some very intelligent people who should have gone to university, etc., etc., and for whatever reason haven't managed to do that. And in more than one case, they really need that validation. And even though they're totally well adjusted and capable and doing really well, they're going back to study. And I think the primary reason they're studying is not particularly to learn stuff. It's to get that validation. So have you ever felt that, William? Have you ever felt that need?
I found that the education process definitely didn't meet my needs for it. It's weird because when I first started school at the age of 5, they did this really strange thing, which they only did for 1 year, where they staggered the start dates of students
Oh,
based
really?
on yes. And being born in July, I was a very, very late starter. So I started months after everybody else had started, and they had already formed friendships. And I came in at the same time as one other kid who, don't want to be mean about it, but he's
Go on, be
no,
mean, be
enough
mean.
said, enough said. You can edit this.
So
Thick as.
you were friends with the least popular person in the class because no one else would talk to you.
There was one kid who they called him Stinky Pirate. And when I think back on him, like he clearly was from a bad household. He had
Yeah.
an iPad. And he stank. So it was like me, Simon, who he really didn't have two brain cells to rub together, and Stinky Pirate. And
That was your team because you couldn't have any
that
other team.
was my team. And so I felt a little bit definitely pushed out. I struggled with friends because it was like that friendship. I was friends with lots of kids, but not close. It was a small school as well. It was a small C of E primary school. That sort of started me off wrong, I think. The teacher didn't have time for it because we were already late and the kids had already learnt this, and my parents ended up going in and complaining about it because we weren't being given any extra time to catch up, and we're being told off for not knowing what the other kids already knew. So that didn't start off great. And then it wasn't until I was about eight that they discovered I needed glasses. So they'd
Right.
already marked me down as, oh, he doesn't pay attention, he's
Yeah, okay.
loud and doesn't interact with the class. So it just sort of started off badly. And then I found it confusing later on. I didn't really understand the weight of the coursework we were doing to GCSE because it had always just been homework. And then suddenly when you hit GCSE, that goes towards your grade. I don't think I've realized that until I was already through GCSE by like a year at that point when I realized, oh God, I'm supposed to keep this stuff. I'm not supposed to just chuck it in the bin. So it just
So, yeah.
using and but I didn't realize I'm actually a very good learner. I learned very practically. So I didn't know how to build a bedroom or a kitchen or run a CNC machine before 3 years ago. And now I'm doing more than the senior employees at my old company ever did.
Wow.
Nobody did the full range. I can paint. We had a dedicated sprayer that all he did was paint, dedicated CNC programmer, a dedicated guy that ran the CNC, and now I do all of those things and much more, and I pick that up very quickly.
Well, that's the danger of labels, again, isn't it? Which itself is a story, isn't it? It's a story that comes from externally, but people are kind of quite happy to internalize it. And that's one of the things that that's my new one of my new things that I'm trying to do is not to never say that I am a so-and-so. So I'm never going to say that I'm a handsome, very intelligent, super explorer person. I'm just going to say that I do clever things. When I look in the mirror, I see a very pleasing visage, and I do lots of canoeing. So, but I'm being serious here, believe it or not. It's kind of you are what you do, and as soon as you answer the question of what am I by saying I'm a so-and-so, you're closing the door and fencing yourself in. God, that was intelligent. Say something, Daryl.
Well, I'm still baffled by the whole concept, honestly, but it's I think I mean I think it's choose what the subject is, what you're good at, then it could be something that covers everything. So I think the how that I'm a learner, I'm an innovator, basically opens up the world to everything, right?
Oh,
So
I
and I think
see.
it's
Yes,
yeah,
yes, yes. That's a
I think
good idea.
if I think I'm yeah if I think horizontally. So I mean I love really what you're saying about the becoming the expert in multiple things inside an organization where people can only do this and only do this and only do this. And I wonder whether that's I mean what society really needs it right now is are people like that that can connect the dots between different disciplines. And I think the world creates lots and lots of specialists, and we now live in a world that needs lots and lots of people that can connect the dots between things. So I'm a cabinet maker and a storyteller and this and this and this. And I think all I've tried to do is to say, okay, well, yeah, I'm an innovator, so I don't mind whether I'm innovating Formula One cars or semiconductor chips or music or whatever. It's my job is to change stuff.
Right, okay, so that's the old other way around. You've actually taken the bot and you've somehow turned it inside out and made it a multiple pathway.
Yeah, I think it's choosing a thing that every discipline needs. And so at some point, every discipline needs innovation, and every discipline needs to be able to tell a story these days. I mean, we live in a world where whoever tells the best story wins. So that I would say that's an absolutely universal skill, no matter whether you're selling kitchens or whether you're building cabinets or writing books. The world needs storytellers.
Well, the story is what gives our products value. So it's not a product that's churned off of a production line, a CNC that routes the doors out. They're just characterless pieces of MDF. ours, we're making them on machines that have been around a lot longer than I have. Some of our machines are from the 1930s. They would have been making plane parts for the war effort.
Right.
They've got their own story. And then we will incorporate things like CNCs to do the drilling for the carcasses, so they are computer accurate. They're going to be as accurate as possible, because when you're building a cabinet, you need it to be as square and as level as possible. So there's no point doing it the old way. The old way is setting up a jig and doing it by hand. That's a skill that isn't going to be lost, because it's so simple. But making the doors by hand on the spindle molder, which, for people listening, if they don't know what a spindle molder is, a spindle with a molding head on it, so a head that contains a cutter, and anything that you run that against a fence, and anything that runs against that is going to cut that profile into the piece. So, like the picture rail behind me up on the wall that I put up this weekend, that we made that art spindle molder, skirting boards, door profiles, they're all made by hand, then cut to size, and we assemble them by hand, squaring them up by hand as well. So that's a skill set which is lost when you're just taking a flat panel with a CNC and routing a square into it. So it's not real. It's not got the same character as a hand-built door, which is it
Well,
requires skill, requires a
that
process.
is complicated. You've got a complicated message there. So how do you come up with a story to sell that to your customer?
I suppose a lot of it is because people are very visual now. So Instagram's a fantastic tool for businesses, and things like Reels, we can show people the doors being made.
Oh, okay.
And we
Right, so
talk,
show not tell sort of thing.
yeah. And I talk about character a lot in our posts, and in our on our website, we've got a page that, if you really want to dive into it, on the about page, we've got a heritage section which talks about the building we're in, because the building we're in is an old engine shed built by Samuel Peto, who built a lot of Victorian infrastructure in his day, and he was involved in the aqueduct that runs through Luxullian Valley.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, he was involved in that. He was involved in loads to do with the railway. And that the so the roundhouse that we're in, the unit on the end, we're getting a second unit soon as well, because we're expanding. That roundhouse, that's what I can't remember his name is. The fellow that did Thomas the Tank Engine, he came to
Right.
visit that site and base the Thomas the Tank Engine roundhouse on our roundhouse.
Oh,
Oh,
right.
really?
Blimey.
Yeah.
Oh,
So
just
these things, these
yeah,
Victorian
yeah.
things, they're full of character and full of story, and we want that to reflect in our work. And you don't get that when it's all shipped in from abroad. You know, a lot of doors, everything's made in Italy. A lot of kitchen stuff's made in Italy. German kitchens are a bit of a thing as well, but a lot of the British stuff is shipped to Ireland and then shipped to the UK. And it's all just churned off a conveyor belt. You know, no one's had their hands on it. No one's crafted it. They've almost it's one step
Yeah.
down, 3D printing.
So, in this kind of world of AI coming on, where you can author something very easily, I think the obvious answer is to take the sort of tack that that William is taking, but not an ex you don't necessarily need to take an extreme version of that where you do everything by hand, because that, I think what William's doing reminds me of that sort of program about Morgan. Who was that? The guy, Morgan Cars. Who was the guy who went in there and told them to sort themselves out?
I think that's one of John Harvey Jones's projects, wasn't it?
John Harvey Jones. And that they literally, before he came along, they were doing everything by hand, literally everything by hand, and they were producing about four cars a year, and it was just, it probably, you know, literally wasn't changing one little bit. And he came along and suggested changes, and they told him to get on his bike basically. But he did go back 10 years later, where the son had taken over, and they'd taken very much the same approach to you. They'd looked at the process they're going through, and they're saying, I know, pressing sheet metal, we'll get a machine to do that, because it's, you know, it takes ages to do it by hand, and people don't necessarily care whether it's been bashed with a hammer. But the certain, you know, they examined the parts where that the story of it being done manually had the maximum impact. So going back on track, which is pretty unusual for me. So you're reading Edith Blyton and Philip Pullman, which so likewise, I did all those, but I never for a second thought I could do this. So why did you?
Well, I've taken a couple of stabs every few years, probably starting when I was about 22, after reading The Shining. I
Right.
love The Shining so much. I've only read it once. I read it, but I need to read it again. And I
Did you
enjoy
read it
it
before you
so much.
saw the film?
I may have done, yes. Yeah, I think I may have done, because I've only watched the film once as well. But
Right.
they're very, very, no. I did watch the film first. I remember reading the book and thinking, this is a different story, an entirely
Okay.
different story. And then having read up on it and Stephen King's opinion of it, he said it's a book about redemption, and the film is absolutely not. Stephen King
About
said that
redemption.
Stanley Kubrick was trying to hurt people with that film. It's a film to hurt people. But I read that and thought this is brilliant, and tried to write my own story and it was pants. I was like, well, enough of that then, I'll give up on that, and then left it for a few years. But again, back to school, if I'd have known that creative writing was something I could have pursued, I would have done, but I really didn't even consider that an option. I always loved reading, so I kept doing English literature and English language, and then did it A level and failed. Because I just couldn't engage with it. I kept thinking, oh, any minute we're going to be writing stories like we did in X year, and we never did. But I wasn't the kind of kid that ever thought to even ask. I was just like, well, English literature, it's English literature. We're going to be writing stories. We never did, and we even dived into stories in a way that wasn't interesting to me. So I found my own interest in them.
Yeah. So having written your first book and decide this is not good, what made you come back?
It was a couple years later, and it was television, actually. It was Twin Peaks. Watching Twin Peaks and being like, this is the most creative and abstract thing ever, and I love it, and I wish I could replicate that. I suppose it's just looking at what other people have done and thinking, I wish I could do that, and then thinking, I probably can do that. I've got to a point where I've read so many stories, especially of ones of authors that I like, that it's almost like a drug addict chasing that initial high, and those days are kind of gone because my imagination's matured, and I'm just eating books like sweets. But writing gives me the same feeling that reading did years ago, and I used to get totally immersed in this world that I was reading up on. I still get that with some books. Every now and then, I'll get very much swept up in a novel, but not as much as it used to.
Right, because I'm reflecting on my own experiences. I'm just thinking the only time that I was writing stories was in English. It was something the whole association with it is something that I did at school. And I just, when I finished university, I just didn't want to do any studying. I didn't do any studying actually for about 20 years. I just stopped. I thought, I've done the studying. I got the badge. Yes, there's another kind of slightly unwarranted side effect of education. So Daryl, what got you into writing?
I sound like very much same as you, William. When I was at school, I did English literature, and that killed my desire to write completely, I would say, because I thought it was going to be, oh, we'll write stories now, and it was no, it was let's analyze other people who've written stories. And I just didn't see the point of it at all.
It's a
So
bit like
my
analysing jokes, isn't it?
well, it's I think it's a fine line. I think analyzing jokes is a really difficult thing to do because it's a great way of killing humor. But I think it's I can understand the idea if you've got to know the rules in order to break the rule. And I think one of my reasons my progress in music has been so slow is because I can't be asked learning the rules. And so therefore, when you think you've broken the rules, you realize, oh shit, if I'd known what the rules were, then I've just worked out what the rule was. So I could have saved myself a lot of time. But I think with story, it's I mean, for me, the rules is the Joseph Campbell stuff, the hero's journey, which if you understand that template, then you've understood the base of most successful literature, I would say. So I've always been fascinated by that. But my start was really in the quiz world, in the non-fiction world. Then there's just no books that I can share with clients that are going to teach them this stuff. So I'm going to have to write my own. So it was just born of necessity. And I wrote one and I thought, okay, well, that's it then. That's got that out of the system. But then it does become a little bit addictive, I think. And so yeah, there's another idea. Here's another idea. Like, we'll write a book about that. So I've had my whiteboard in front of me. There's about 40 different book titles on there that at some point they're
40
going to be written.
now.
Yeah, it's
It
shocking,
was
really.
10 the last time I
Well, no, well,
heard.
there's 10 that are approaching completion. I'm far better at starting things and finishing things, but their total list. There's a lot of things on there that I would love to be able to do, but I didn't start.
So I read your story, which we'll have to, one of your stories, which is based on your haunted house. So is that based on a true story?
Slightly. Bodmin's a characterful place with characterful people, and I just love the people of Bodmin, and I love getting to know people. I mean, part a lot of my job is getting to know people and getting on first name basis with clients, getting to know their needs and getting to know them. And I go to people's houses, so I just love chatting to people. So the people of Bodmin very much inspired me when I first moved here, and I started writing a story. A novel about a couple that moved to Bodmin, and the town just gets more and more mental as he gets more obsessed with the town, because that's how I was feeling at the time. I was getting obsessed with the town, and I've shelved it because it was a bit bigger than me. I will revisit it as I'm sort of sharpening my literary tools. But the was it the Hole in the Wall story you read?
Yeah, it was the hole in the. So basically, the hole in the wall story is your first house that you. It starts with you moving into your first house.
Yes. So the dog, Nigel, he did keep going outside and sticking his face in a hole in the wall, and we couldn't figure out what he was doing. And then I started to, like, just saying creepy things about, yeah, what if he does this, and what if it's this, and what if he climbs in and never comes back? And I ended up writing a quick story and liked it, submitted it, and it got published. So that was my first bit of success.
So, and I read that, and I very much enjoyed it. Very much enjoyed it.
Oh, good.
So, but I'm just fascinated that you've got this, place. This place is inspiring you so much. Because you're able to reach out and interact with it more deeply than I do with place.
Well, I especially around here, like the moors, I find the moors very inspiring. And like you did the episode on rituals, which I enjoyed listening to. And I'm very much into the idea of little rituals in people's lives, which you don't think of as rituals, but they are quite ritualistic, like making a cup of tea or rolling a cigarette. They're little rituals, social rituals. And I think when you go out on the moors, it's such a raw place. So untouched by people, and there's something in that which is inspiring, and it's almost like it's compelling me to say something. I don't know what that thing is yet, but I have something to say about the moors. One day I will say it. But a lot of my stories do tie into the moor in some way. So the bigger there was another novel which I'd started on before moving to Cornwall, but obviously I've been coming a lot. My parents living here, my grandparents have been living here for a long time. And after watching Twin Peaks, I had this idea for like this kind of like big ensemble cast kind of novel with all these different centered around a girl that has gone missing, very much like Twin Peaks, but it's a murder in Twin Peaks. That ties in with drug trafficking and people trafficking and the moors again, because the River Foy originates from the moor. And it's such a beautiful river full of life that's inspired loads of other writers, like I can't remember his name, he's the Wind in the Willows, that was written about
Oh
the River Foy.
yes.
Obviously Daphne du Maurier lived in Foy, right on the river. And I think it's rivers are they are life-giving things, and people we build around them, gravitate around them, and societies build up around water sources, transport sources of water, sources of food. And that one in particular starts on the moor, which I think is a fascinating place anyway. So we have in this bigger novel, which I haven't finished writing or even got a tenth of the way through, or even maybe a 30th of the way through, It is about the river and about the moor and about people.
Right. William and Gail. So I met William on a creative writing, which was very, very good. So Gail was our teacher, and we're hoping to have William and Gail back on, kind of writing full-on novels, because I came out of that course with the realization that there are so many blooming decisions to make in writing a novel, and I'm not going to it now, that you have to be massively creative, and you also have to be massively creative because there's so many people done it. To do a good one, it's a real kind of challenge to make it stand out from the crowd. But anyway, so how would you characterize the people of Bodmin then? What makes them
They are a bit weird. But
in a very nice way? Yeah.
they are, yeah, in a very, very nice way. So having lived in Bristol, where everything is a city and it's very creative, but it's very cliquey, it's very up its own arse. And coming to somewhere like Bodmin, where everybody's just living life in a very humble way, I'd say. And the local butchers is still thriving, the local greengrocers is still thriving, the local cafes are still thriving. But at the same time, it is quite deprived. A lot of the big chains have pulled out of the town centre. The local pub, I don't know if you've seen recently, the local pub, the Hole in the Wall, which is where me and Tanya, that's our local, was given the Canberra Best Pub of the Year award,
Oh,
and then
really?
it stripped away from them because they had a Nazi armband on the
Oh,
wall.
yeah.
Yeah,
Oh,
and
I
that
didn't see
was,
that. I didn't see
yeah,
that.
it was actually brought over as a war souvenir by a local troop. I'm not sure if there was any, it's ever been attributed to anyone specifically, but it was brought over as a souvenir and put up on the wall with various other war souvenirs.
Yeah, just
Somebody
interesting
come
bits and
in.
pieces.
Yeah, but they've taken it down, and I think I've heard they're going to get the award reinstated now because a lot of people rallied around the pub and the landlord, Steve, who's been there 20 years. And it's a lovely pub. You go down on a Sunday and they've got cheese and crackers out on the side. And we went down there for his 20th year party, and they had like a men's choir in there singing these brilliant old Cornish songs and sea shanties, and they had food on for free, a big spread, and just the atmosphere is fantastic, and the people are fantastic, and they're very welcoming, very friendly, very interesting people. But Bodmin itself, it did have the Bodmin Mental Asylum, which was the big mental
Yeah.
asylum which serviced the whole of the southwest basically, and had people from all over. And then you've also got the Bodmin Jail, which was the big jail which serviced the whole of the southwest. And those two in conjunction, like, they're just such stunning but imposing buildings. And I think when the Care and the Community Act came in and they just kind of let these people go and live in the local area, they bred, didn't they? So there's a lot of really zany people.
Right, so you just got our podcast banned for being so outrageously politically correct.
I mean, there's a bloke that lives over the road, and he stands in his doorway, and he's about 7 feet tall. He's massive, and he has a big white python around his neck, and he just stands,
Python,
a
a
python,
snake.
yeah, snake, and he just stands at the door with his snake and his coffee, and that's just Bobbin in a nutshell.
There's a story in its own right. I mean, just coming back to the hole in the wall pub for a second. I heard the armband story. I didn't know the camera award before that. I mean, there's classic the media distorting things, because I'm just thinking, okay, there's an example of a bad pub, but no, there's an award-winning pub that just happens to have an unfortunate bit of souvenirism on the wall. And it, for me, just reinforces this whole idea of whoever tells the best story wins, and failing to capture the right story. But I mean, great! It'd be fantastic if the community brings it round and rescues that one, and the award comes back again. That will be perhaps the real story.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is as well is Steve put a statement down and said, this award meant a lot to us and the people of Bodmin because
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
there's been some violence and a couple of deaths here in the last year. But people view Bodmin in a certain way, which I think is unfair. They do I mean, having just said that everyone here is mental, it's everyone is lovely, and there's so many good things about Bobbin, but everyone seems to think it's rough. Everyone see, I say, oh, you know, I live in Bobbin, they go, oh, what's that like? Oh, sorry to hear that. And you're like, you've got no idea. Like in the Midlands, we lived in Northampton for a little bit, and we couldn't open our front window because people would come banging on the window asking for change, or they'd just throw rubbish through. So
Really?
they,
Oh my
yeah.
goodness.
Two of our friends that live here, they're from Manchester. Both of their next door neighbours in Manchester were herring at it, and
Right,
they'd be
right.
screaming out on the front lawn with no clothes on. And it's like you don't get anything like that here. And then when we have a bit of violence that makes the news, it reinforces that negative
Yeah.
opinion of Bodmin in
Well,
people's minds.
it's in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. So Cornwall is full of old people who walk their dogs, and
Yeah.
they write to the newspaper if somebody's put some litter on litter in the wrong place. So yeah, to have anything going on, I think there's probably about three policemen cover the whole place, basically. It's
Yeah.
not a lot going on.
No.
So anything going on in Bodmin is going to stand out, and once you've got the reputation, it's going to be magnified.
Definitely. Yeah. Small
But
towns
yeah,
talk.
there's a story going on in the main news story at the moment. I don't know if you've seen it, because in London every weekend there's been big marches protesting against what's happening in Gaza right now. And so what happened? There's a Jewish chap who is a bit of a stirrer, who wanted, wearing his little cap, he wanted to go and basically stand in front of the march that was coming along, and the police, not unreasonably, in my opinion, tried to stop him because he thought he might cause trouble. And so the press, a lot of the press in the UK right now, are saying it's totally outrageous. You know, he's not allowed to be Jewish in London. Whereas if it was an Arsenal supporter who wanted to run in front of a load of Chelsea supporters in a provocative way, no one would say anything. But that's because the press wouldn't get behind him. And in this case, the press has got behind him, and so they're now calling for the resignation of the head of the Met Police because his terrible, uncouth policeman asked trying to keep the two sides apart. So this is quite shocking. So Daryl, on you have pretensions at least to write non-fiction books. Is that true?
Well, I have, but it's not well known, but I have written one, and so one of the books on the website is non-fiction. Sorry, it is fiction.
Oh,
Yeah, but I put it out under a pen name.
and what's the title of said tome?
It is called Templeton Three.
And what's it about?
It's about Rolls-Royce, basically.
Oh, it's a
Yes.
sort of a memoir, is it?
It's well, there's a lot of fiction. Well, it is fiction, but it's yeah. I think yeah. But what Bill Williams been saying, it's got to be based on something that you know, right? Write about what you know. And yeah, it's about the failure of organizations to be able to innovate, or the failure of big organizations.
Right, and does it have a love interest?
It does, which I know when I've spoken to people who've read the book, they've found that annoying.
Again, it's that so that I congratulate you. So normally I love taking the piss out of Daryl, but I think congratulations for doing that because it's definitely outside your comfort zone.
It is, but yeah, my big ambition is to write a yeah classic fiction book, but that's you keep telling me I'm not allowed to until I've done all my other things.
Yes, and
But
that's totally correct because we've got more important things to do, and you can do that in his dotage. So,
dotage, yeah, yes.
because he never finishes anything off.
Well, I've been
We're
quite a few flash fictions. Maybe you should get a few flash fics under your belt.
yes,
Yeah,
yes. So, well,
say.
one way to stop yourself doing anything is, well, it would be a second novel. My second novel is going to be the greatest novel in history, basically. It's quite a high bar, isn't it? It's quite a high bar to give yourself. No, I do salute your ambition, and without ambition, or with ambition, you can do great things. That's for sure. In fact,
Yes.
that is an interesting thing. So many authors come out with the first novel, and it kind of breaks through, and they become super famous. And it's a bit like first albums in music. Oh, there we go, Daryl. So it's like over the years, it's kind of all these influences have pent up inside you, and then they come out in this expressive artistic format, and they
Yeah.
kind of peak right there and then.
Yeah, I think also there's the element of learning from failure, but not just your own, it's all other people's. I mean, I think a lot of the authors that I admire, they weren't successful with their first manuscript. They were, I mean, Ian Banks, wrote what, seven or eight before he could
Right,
get one
right.
published. J.K. Rowling famously was rejected by almost every publisher. And the publisher did take a chance, said we'll print 500 copies and see what happens. And so I think the publishing industry becomes a major hazard to innovation again, because they understand a formula, and any author that comes along with a different formula is going to find life difficult, because all the criteria that the publishing houses use to measure success, and should we invest in this one, basically it doesn't acknowledge that somebody's going to come along and break the rules. And I think the big publishing companies, they end up almost accepting that and saying, okay, well, yeah, we'll come along and mop up J.K. Rowling's second book and third book after somebody's taken a chance, and that they've broken through. But the industry's, I would say, literally set up to not innovate and not reward the innovator.
Well, I think
Which is maybe.
Gail said something interesting about the publishing industry when she spoke about 50 Shades of Grey. So when that came out, which was a Twilight fan fiction to start with, and that came out, that was self-published, and it just blew people away and became this massive success. And the publishing industries were like, the publishing houses just said, we don't know why everybody wants this. So they've realized they don't really actually know what people want. So apparently they are starting to get a bit more experimental, but I still think that it's an old club, isn't it? And the big boys have been the big boys for a long time.
I think so. I mean, going back to what we were saying earlier in this conversation, I think the people that work in publishing houses, based on my experience, which is fairly limited, they were the ones that went through the English literature GCSE and A level and degree. So they got taught all the rules. They never did any creative writing themselves, but they know the rules of classic fiction. That's again, you've now locked in a system which is not going to recognize innovation, and it's certainly not going to encourage it.
Also, because if we do get Gail on this program, she'll kill me, because I've just given the impression that people just turn up, write their first book, and it's a great success. Because what she would emphasize is that to get to that first book, there's been a hell of a lot of blind alleys and blood, sweat, and tears. Because I think it is pretty much a myth that people just turn up and they've already got the ability to write a best-selling book. It might be that they've been writing stories since they could, before they could walk. Which is that's the case with a lot of singers, isn't it, Daryl?
Yeah, I think so. I think, yeah, I mean, I think there's in the old system, and what I mean by that is before things like American Idol and The Voice and so on, then the establishment expected people to pay their dues. Yeah, so you learned your craft, and you did it in a pub somewhere in a different country, probably Beatles. We'll go to Hamburg. Yeah, and we'll
Yeah,
just
yeah.
spend 10,000 hours playing in Hamburg before. We expose ourselves to the big wide world. So I think there's an element of that which kind of disappears these days. But you've got to pay your dues, and I think you've got to have that persistence to know that the first thing you write is rubbish, and the second thing you write is probably also rubbish. But you've still got that grit that says, no, I'm going to keep going with this, and I'll eventually get there. I don't know if
Well,
that's been
that's
your experience
yeah.
with him.
Well, I think there's an interesting change in a lot of creative industries, music included, where self-promotion is very much expected, but in a different way. So, like you say about sort of getting, you earn, used to earn your stripes and do the pub scene. Now there's a lot of industry plants, which is always really been going on. Like Billie Eilish, she's from a family. They've made her out deal. She writes her own songs. She produces
In
her
the
own music with her
bedroom and
brother.
all that business, yeah.
Her mum's a famous actress, so she had all the contacts there, and she had the right look. She came out with the right sound at the right time, so they pushed her to the forefront. But if you spend a lot of time on Instagram, which is and Instagram has just become an advertising platform, really. I'm constantly getting really good sounding musicians that made way better music than my bands ever did back in the day. And they've got a great sound and a great image, but some of them you don't even realize they're musicians at first because they're doing comedy reels to get views, to get attention to the page. You've got to have that big following before they'll even look at you. And it's the same in the literary world. I follow quite a few young authors, and they all are making content. They're like content creators, which I hate that term. So they're just churning out content, usually about books or their book specifically, to engage people on a level that I think is probably unseen before in the literary world. So they're talking about what goes on in their book before the book's been published, and they're talking about little plot twists and making memes about it and trying to make it go viral. And that to me, I'm never going to be that person. I do well on my business's Instagram, but to promote myself in that way, I think I'd struggle. I think that's the new side of literary, the publishing house. They expect you to come to the table with a following already established, which I don't think they ever did that before.
So, I mean, so where does that leave you? I mean, are you just happy to say, right, well, I just enjoy writing and I'm going to keep doing it? And if people find me, then great. And if they don't, then I'll still keep writing anyway.
Yeah, I think so. I've definitely got the bug, and I've not been doing it the last 2 weeks. I've been cracking on with the house at every spare minute, putting up picture rail and laying floor and painting and finishing electrics and doing all sorts. I haven't been doing as much writing the last 2 weeks, but before that, I was writing every evening, a little bit on the weekend, and I was also having Gail edit some of my stories for me as well. So I've had her read three of my flash fictions, give me a bit of feedback. One of them was just her basically saying, "Oh, I think it's lacking in this area." And I said, "Well, actually, that was what I wrote originally, but I took it out because I thought people wouldn't get it." She knows I get it, put it back in. So sometimes, just having a second person have a look at it's really good. But I've enjoyed that whole process. So I'll keep doing it regardless. And I do think some of my stories are pretty good. So I think they probably could get picked up. I just want someone to pick it up and read it and be like, "Yeah, I get it. I get that. That's for me." So whether that's short stories or a full novel, I will build up the full novel, but as I said, I'm very much sort of honing the skills in short stories and flash fictions at the moment. It's a great way when you get an idea and you've got to get it on paper before it runs out of your head and you get bored of it. Flash fictions and short stories are a great way to do that. Then you might want to go back and expand on that later.
So,
Yeah,
Daryl,
that's
you're allowed to do that. You have my permission.
it's so the book that I referred to earlier that we did publish, I did write a book of short stories beforehand because I love short stories. And I did play the game a little bit, sending things off to publishers. And it's like the overwhelming message was no, the public won't read short stories. But again, that was going to the traditional publishing industry. And I think the whole domain of flash fiction these days, and I think even people writing novels on Twitter, and just that's very short, sharp. I think it's a whole different world in terms of getting stuff out there. But I found that the discipline of short story writing, and I'd go a step further and say even very short story writing. So I think can you write a story in 100 words, 50 words? And I think that is an amazing discipline.
So that's like the haikus of story writing sort of thing.
Thinking it, I mean, yeah, I don't know whether it started with Ernest Hemingway, but he's famous for that 6-word story, a competition amongst his literary friends of how few words can you write to convey a story to people,
Is that the
and
one
how
about the shoes or something?
the baby
Got
shoes,
shoes in it? Yes. Right.
for sale, baby shoes never worn.
If they were Doc Martens, I know where to find them. They're on the shelf. So the
There's a
interesting
whole
thing,
new level to
William,
that story.
I must share with you is that because Darren and I go back a long way, but in the middle, I've not seen him very much. See, and I don't know, I've been doing stuff. He's been reading every book that's ever been written. Okay, So if I talk on a subject, he kind of says, "Oh yeah, I've met that person. I've actually written a book about it, or I've been to presented at a conference." So lo and behold, we get somebody on about stories, and we've got a non-fiction novel and a book of short stories there. So
If
he's
there's
doing
any publishers out
it
there.
again. So Darryl, what I admire about William is his self-confidence. I was wondering, you've got to go through this learning period where you say you write something and you think, "Oh, that's not good enough. I need to write another one or change it or whatever." And the question is, where, I think for some people that they never get to that stage where they think it's good enough, and that's a big problem because you at some stage you've got to publish and be damned. So specifically, Daryl, if you go back to your novel, and when's the last time you read it?
Oh, blimey. I don't know, 5 years ago.
And right, so you did, and what do
Haven't,
you think of it? Is it any good?
I think it stands up. Yeah, I think it stands up. So I actually enjoyed reading it because I kind of sat down to write a book that I'd enjoy reading myself, which combined the thrills of engineering with a love interest
Right. Well,
and
gosh.
innovation.
So I think we've done very well. We've actually gone on for over an hour. So I'm going to start wrapping this episode up. I must admit, because I got up at 5 o'clock and then paddled for 35 kilometers this morning, and I was a bit brain dead. So I came to this podcast thinking, "Oh, goodness, no. Goodness knows how this is going to go." But William's been an absolute star and taken us to places, specifically Bodmin, that we haven't been that often. So thank you very much for that, William. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, likewise.
And you've been also very good at weaseling things we didn't know about Daryl. So you'll have to supply me a link to your book. And William, if you've got any other
Well,
links you want to send to your
funnily
high
enough, there's
end.
yeah, if I get anything else picked up for publication, I'll let you know. So far, I've got about a dozen rejections, but they
Well,
do say
that's
that's what you
badge of
want.
honor. That is badge of honor.
Framed on the wall.
That's it. Put them on the spike, put them on the nail.
So, right. So, cheerio, everybody. It's been fun. Thank you ever so much.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
That's it for another episode of Danger Mouth. So it's goodbye from Mikey and Daryl, and hopefully we'll see you for the next episode.